This is Crossroads, a Get Religion podcast.
When the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood issued their so-called Nashville statement several weeks ago with some rather prominent famous names signed underneath, we knew that this was going to get at least a little bit of coverage. There have been reactions to the Nashville statement, some of them tongue-in-cheek, some of them more serious, some of them simply ad hoc, and some of them kind of purposeful, that Nashville statement on sexuality. How has the media covered those? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. And he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
How would you compare the media coverage of the Nashville statement on sexuality and the media coverage of its reactions, the reactions from the left?
Well, it's actually interesting in that I think the Denver statement got more coverage than I anticipated originally, in large part because there was a story on reactions to the Nashville statement written by the Gannett newspaper chain. And so that put the story in play, at least a few places. The key, though, is that the reaction by the Denver statement was treated as a reaction story to the Nashville statement. In other words, the news here was that people stood up for traditional, you know, Christian, centuries of Christian doctrine, and thus they're drawing angered responses. I would say that there was very little reaction to what was actually in the Denver statement. In other words, in terms of what it said. In other words, it basically was portrayed as a rejection of the Nashville statement, which it was. It wasn't portrayed as a document that might contain newsworthy material in and of itself. Does that make any sense?
Yes, I think I understand. In other words, you're saying that the content of the Denver statement was kind of more or less irrelevant because we all know what it's going to say in reaction to that crazy Nashville statement. But simply the fact that somebody registered their disagreement was enough for the media. Is that it?
Well, in other words, this is a reaction to the things that the Nashville statement said that made people mad, like the mayor of Nashville and other groups that are kind of portrayed as mainstream Christian, whereas, you know, that exotically titled evangelical organization. And you still, I mean, stop and think about it. I mean, evangelicals have a tendency, even kind of on their best days, to word things in ways that other people would find fascinating. Now, picture yourself sitting in a liberal newsroom. 90% of the people in the room are liberal on abortion, 95% are liberal on anything related to sexuality or gay rights. It's an elite newsroom in the Acela zone between Washington and Boston. And you get a press release from a group that calls itself the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. Doesn't that have kind of like an exotic flair to it? You know, from their perspective, I mean, like, you're trying to picture the softball team, right, with the jersey, you know, on the front, you know, that this is the team from the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. Manhood and womanhood alone is going to raise eyebrows, let alone, you know, whatever they say. And by the way, I say that in no way detrimental to the organization. It is an organization of evangelicals speaking to evangelicals. We've already talked about that. But meanwhile, something comes out just called the Denver statement, and it's from a church with a title, you know, that says something, you know, she was the founder. The person behind this is a media star in her own right with New York Times bestsellers, someone who is portrayed overwhelmingly sympathetically in numerous media portrayals, portraits in places like the Washington Post. And she's the founder of a church called the House for All Sinners and Saints. Now, that's going to be portrayed instantly as kind of quirky, but quirky interesting, whereas the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood is quirky, but it's quirky, huh? You know, from the viewpoint of secular reporters. So out comes this statement, and it probably was seen, you know, as a liberal document, which it is, but at the same time, it has content. I mean, it's cited on the website of Boltz Weber. Her website is called Sarcastic Lutheran. We can turn to the L word there later. And but in this case, the L word means Lutheran, not something else. That this is a website that this documents the work of the queer, trans, gay, lesbian, bisexual, genderqueer, asexual, straight, single, married, image-bearing Christians at that congregation, which is a congregation of about 250 people, but still, because of her fame and its location and its quotability, a congregation that gets quite a bit of coverage. So the issue here is, does the Denver Statement actually have any content other than serving as kind of a normal, from the viewpoint of many reporters, a normal response to that crazy fundamentalist statement, you know, that came out from the Nashville guys?
Talk about the fact, and I've often said of Nadia Boltz Weber that she is kind of straight out of central casting.
What's central casting?
Well,
central casting?
The culture's central casting. If I were going to, say, make a film about a hip, I got to be a female pastor working the streets at Denver and kind of uniting people of the community, I could not make a better character sketch than Nadia Boltz Weber. She is walking cliche, if you ask me.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think she's... I'm going to disagree with you. I don't think she's a cliche at all. I think she's beyond a cliche. I mean, in the sense that the bright young woman with a graduate degree from somewhere who's really smart and likes to have a beer at the local pub, that gets you onto BBC. A 6'1", weightlifting, tattooed, former stand-up comedy and drug addict with a New York Times bestseller, that's taking everything another couple of notches forward. And the fact that she gets up with that, you know, how many curse words can I use in this sermon approach of hers, and addresses, quite frankly, things like why she believes in the resurrection, you know, as well as what she says about sexuality and stuff, I think she's downright edgy, even if she's edgy in some ways that you might put together. But there's just no, you can't be a stereotype unless there's somebody else like her.
Well, she's edgy in every way that the culture accepts as edgy.
Right.
Every single way.
But I don't think anybody else combines all these factors to the same degree. So I can't think of her as a stereotype if there's only one of her.
Oh, then I'd say she's a combination of stereotypes.
Okay.
She
is simply the new, she's a superhero. You know, from their perspective, she deserves her own comic books. She's, as they would say in the 60s, she's far out. You know, with no scare quotes needed. She's articulate. She says things in a way that would even get the attention of someone like Rod Dreher, who famously noted once upon a time, he said, you know, I probably don't agree with this woman on much of anything, but I wouldn't mind being in a foxhole with her if we were both under attack. The issue, though, is what would Rod and this woman agree on enough that they would ever be under attack by the culture? So in some ways, this Denver statement is one of the first times we have this woman and her church getting really candid about what they believe about sexuality. Now, I haven't read her book, so there may be material that are in her books that are this candid. But in the things I have read about her in the past, there is doctrinal content in the Denver statement that raised my eyebrows way up. And I say that just as a news reporter who, you know, a long time ago, it was everybody else treated. I'll give you an example. In the 80s, boy, that's a long flashback. In the 80s, the Presbyterian Church USA put out a statement about marriage and sexuality. It was written by someone, I believe, from either the Disciples of Christ or the United Church of Christ. It was a church to the left of the PCUSA then and now. But this committee put out a statement, and buried down in this progressive document, which primarily got coverage because of its early, early strong language in favor of gay rights, way down in this document was a statement that essentially said, you know, I don't think we can write off the possibility that the Holy Spirit might lead some people to commit adultery, and that the adultery might, in some cases, broaden people's emotional horizons and lead them to new truths that wouldn't be found in their marriage. Now, when that document came out, everybody wrote stories about what it had to say about gay rights. When I saw that document, I just flipped because I recognized this is a story. Do we have any other mainstream organization in American religion making a theological case for the morality of adultery? Probably not. That's not the hot button social issue in the news, but do you see what I'm getting at when I'm saying that that's actually a bigger story? In terms of breaking new ground on the Christian left?
So what was in the Denver statement in reaction to the Nashville statement that you feel fell into that category?
Well, if you look through the statement, you try to find any limits whatsoever on sexual behavior. Read the thing and try to find them. I ended my column for Universal on this by stressing, the way I wrote it was, in one of its clearest doctrinal statements on sexual ethics, Bowles Weber and her flock stressed, quote, "We deny that the only type of sexual expression that can be considered holy," now the big word there is holy, "and any, that the only type of sexual expression that can be considered holy is between a cisgendered heterosexual married couple who waited to have sex until they were married. If you fit into that group, good for you. We have no problem with your lifestyle choices," which is clever. You know, the last point there. But stop and think about it. If there is holy sexuality as acts of sexual expression, which I think has to some degree to be considered sexual intercourse of whatever form, it's holy, yet it's outside of heterosexual marriage, and that this gives you multiple forms of sexuality being considered holy outside the boundaries of marriage. There's no limitation anywhere in here on, it doesn't mention adultery, I don't think. I don't remember adultery coming up. But basically, when I asked people who had read the Nashville statement what struck them as newsworthy in the Denver statement, it wasn't what it said about trans issues, for that matter, or what it said about gay issues. All of that was pretty much expected. It was this statement basically bashing the idea that sexuality was supposed to be within a faithful married relationship. I don't know if that's going to get any coverage anywhere, but it's intriguing to me. Now, let me connect that to something that you and I have talked about many times, but I want to remind listeners to it. At Get Religion, there's something that long ago some of my colleagues in the field of religion writing started calling the TMAT Trio. And the TMAT Trio was a series of questions that back in the 80s I began asking, not because I was trying to grill people theologically, you know, for my own jollies, But I found that these three questions helped beget interesting answers from Christian leaders. And they were answers that as they tried to answer or as they refused to answer, what people said in answer to these three questions was often quite revealing. Now, to remind you what those three were, I know we've discussed them before, but I'll put them back on the record. Number one was the resurrection actually happened. It was an event in real time in history. What really matters, the resurrection actually happened. Question number two is salvation is found through Jesus Christ alone. In other words, that's essentially a question about universalism. The third question, though, and this is where the wording intrigued some friends of mine, including the late George Gallup Jr., was very intrigued by this wording and began using it some in his work at Gallup. And also John Green, the great professor of statistics and polling at the University of Akron, was intrigued with this wording. And then later, Lifeway Research in Nashville actually used this wording in a poll and tested the trio of doctrines. This third part was worded simply this: sex outside of marriage is sin. Now, what intrigued them about that was that it doesn't have any reference whatsoever to homosexuality. It simply says, on the real dominant issue of America statistically, which would be sexual relations of all kind, but sexual relations between heterosexuals, sex outside of marriage is sin. Whether that's premarital sex, extramarital sex, whatever, it's pretty hard to deny that the Christian tradition is that sex outside of marriage is sin. Now, you ask that question to a lot of liberal Protestants and things get really evasive, because you're asking them to go on the record both on the adultery question and on the issue of premarital sex. And even in an age when premarital sex is quite common, even among, you know, conservative evangelical young people, etc., it's still hard to say, well, you know what? After 2,000 years, the church was wrong on that issue. The Denver Statement is exceedingly clear, right up front, and says over and over, the church was wrong on these points. God is leading us. The Holy Spirit is leading us to correct church history, to correct doctrine. In fact, there was another statement that came out in reaction to Nashville that came out from a group called Christians United in support of LGBT plus inclusion in the church. And in its preamble, it had this very blunt statement: in every generation, there are those who resist the Spirit's leading in various ways and cling to the dogmas and traditions that God is calling us to rethink and reform. Now, that's a very interesting sentence. In the Denver Statement, they made it very clear something similar. Let me read one of the actual statements there. Western culture is embarking upon a massive revision of what it means to be a human being by expanding the limits and definitions previously imposed by fundamentalist Christians. By and large, the spirit of our age discerns and delights in the beauty of God's design for human life that is so much richer and more diverse than we have previously understood it to be. Now, fundamentalist Christianity, historically speaking, is a phenomena of the very late 19th and early 20th century within Protestantism in America. The fundamentals of the faith is where this term came from. Let me read that sentence again, because this, once again, this is news that I don't think people realize is news. Western culture has embarked upon a massive revision of what it means to be a human being. Now note, we think gay, it's not. We think gay rights is right. We think this or that. We are changing the definition of what it means to be a human being. That sound you hear is the late Pope John Paul II going, "What?" By expanding the limits and definitions previously imposed by fundamentalist Christians. Todd, who were the fundamentalist Christians in the first 1900 years of Christian history? I mean, who got it wrong for 1900 years? Wouldn't that pretty much be everybody?
Terry, a final question for you.
Okay. You're going to duck that one.
Well, I think the answer is obvious, but Nadia Bolz-Weber is a clergy member in the largest Lutheran church body in the United States, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I want your advice. How does a smaller conservative Lutheran church body get on the radar screen of secular reporters? How should, say, for instance, my church body, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, respond to stories like this, that the media consumers don't assume that the ELCA represents millions of faithful Lutherans in America, that Nadia Bolz-Weber speaks for us?
To be fair, she is often viewed as an apologist for the ELCA, but this statement is from her congregation, not from the ELCA. But it's hard not to identify her. In other words, I think the ELCA is on the record in terms of gay marriage, ordination of gays and lesbians, etc. But there are lines in the Denver statement that I think if you brought them up at an ELCA convention, you would have lively and heated debate about them. I don't think the ELCA would be ready to go this far. But back to your question. First of all, who are the Missouri Synod Lutherans? I think that's the hypothetical. Yeah, you were hashtag asking for a friend, right? Yeah, and that friend is the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Who are the mainstream journalists in the fold of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? Can you name me a short list?
Well, I can name you a very short list of two, of Mark and Molly Hemingway.
And their last name both is Hemingway. Mm-hmm. Okay, first of all, it would help if Missouri Synod Lutheran schools had journalism departments and taught mainstream journalism and had anybody out there working in these newsrooms. Can we agree on that?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's my drum. I'm going to beat on it because I think the church is as much to blame for a lot of these media conundrums as the Acela Zone newsrooms.
Absolutely. That's a long-term solution.
Okay. In the here and now, at the very least, St. Louis is not a small media market. If you called a press conference in St. Louis, you probably would have something end up on the Associated Press wire. I think that's a good possibility. If a bunch of articulate Missouri Synod Lutherans got on an airplane and flew to New York and presented themselves at the front door of the New York Times or the Associated Press, that might get some coverage. It certainly would be mentioned on Twitter. But you would have to have a really spunky, articulate, and hopefully pushy statement of what's wrong with the Denver statement. And let's put it this way. Buried back in the past, there was a guy who was pretty decent with sound bites named Martin Luther. If you could come up with some Martin Luther on some of these issues, and I think he had a few things to say about marriage. I'm not sure about sex, but Martin Luther had a lot of blunt things to say about a lot of things. It would be really helpful if you could walk up and say, "I don't think Luther would think this is funny," and take it on at that level. You need to think of it both as accurate doctrine, but also as quotable expressions of what your church believes, and you need people who are willing to be quoted. And then maybe you ask Molly to bring it up on Fox, but that's secondary to what she does as a professional and whatever else, because it's valid news. I think she might be willing to mention it or discuss it or whatever. But it's not Molly Ziegler Hemingway's job to bring this sort of stuff up. it's the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church's job to make a statement of what it believes and make a case for it in ways that are funny, quotable, pushy, and doctrinally accurate, and take Luther as their guide on how you do that sort of thing.
Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.